We work a lot with large organizations as well as small organizations. And I think that puts us in quite a unique position to understand some of the challenges that are being faced across South Africa and I think across the African continent. So for today's conversation, we'll talk a lot about how R&D and academia can combine with industry and small businesses and enterprises in South Africa. How do they create a partnership for bringing African-built AI solutions to African companies? How do we expand the presence of AI in Africa by leveraging what's being done globally, but applying it and real AI to fine-tuning it to the context of the environment that we operate in? So from my point of view, I'll take on the perception of small business as Milieu AI, but also from some of the challenges that we've seen in the enterprises and other small organizations that we've worked with in South Africa. Thanks.
Martin.
Yes, hi everyone, Martin. I first want to compliment the previous panel. I think that was absolutely brilliant, very insightful, one of the best panels I've heard this year. To connect to that at the end also. So quickly about AI Sweden, we are a not-for-profit public-private partnership, if you wish. Then having the mission to accelerate the use of AI in Sweden, primarily private and public sector. And my perspectives are very close to Greg's, although we do this from, so to say, a nation's perspective. How do you do this with as much force and as much speed as possible, and do that on a very broad basis across the ecosystem? How do you learn across the ecosystem? How do you build knowledge across the ecosystem and so on? We have been busy for 5.5 years, 140 partners, as Lukas said, and they are cross sectors. So we really try to find the common questions, the common things that we can build on, and MLOps happens to be one, obviously. And if you do this in collaboration, it can be really, really powerful. So I hope I can contribute with some perspectives on that.
Thank you. And indeed, I'll echo your gratitude for the previous panel. It was very insightful. And I apologize in advance. I can't shake my corporate background. I do everything with slides. So this is a topic that I've been quite focused on for the last little while here, this idea of man and machine partnering and repair. And so this is just a little bit more context around my background. As Lukosi mentioned, 20 years at Thomson Reuters, specifically in the data space. Really, it's one of the largest global data companies, and doing everything from building data products that were online back in the day, all the way through to experimenting with new ideas around how we might think about data science. I spent a lot of time trying to and working with students to demystify big tech in a way that allows them to feel more part of the process and democratizing innovation and their role in the space. We are natural collaborators, we like to call ourselves. So we work together very well with other people all the time, and we like to work on big challenges. And I will apologize in advance to the pessimists in the room. I am absolutely unashamedly optimistic and definitely glass half full type of person. So expect that in all my answers. And so here we're chatting about, industry's role in, right? Sort of the thought around man and machine partnering to repair. That really means to me, like, what is industry's role in building these purpose-driven intelligences, right? These super tools that can really help us build these generative futures that we know we all need. What does that look like? And what data do we need to do that? And then how might industry then help define the future of data, right? How do we expand the definition of data and economics in general? Okay, so if you think about private sector, it really represents about 6% of global GDP. So we really can't do this without the private sector, without industry. I think these kinds of conversations, university, private sector coming together, is absolutely critical because it gives the space to actually innovate that, quite frankly, private sector doesn't have, because they've got the quarterly earnings sort of drumbeat always that limits the transformational impact of innovation. And as a true business person, having grown up in global business, this idea of only claiming value if you actually create it, I think it's something we may have lost a little bit along the way. So I want to kind of pull that back. So there's and we'll talk about a lot of these in the questions, but there's lots going on in academia around how we might redefine the future of economics, the future of value exchange. And I think that industry corporates need to be more part of that conversation so that those outcomes can be more practical. So super inspired by this idea, these ideas, like who's building the data science, who's it for, and whose interests are in mind. So keeping that always top of mind in the way that we think about innovation from a data perspective. And this final slide, and I think a lot of these sort of examples will come up in my answers, but thankfully there are many organizations in industry and elsewhere that are kind of thinking about these challenges and working together in interesting ways to pull them forward.
Thanks, and maybe you can keep that.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. We'll just keep that. Now, thanks for those introductory remarks. I think maybe leading on from there, the one part that I think will be very interesting for both the people in the room and online is your views on how do you see AI transforming key industries in South Africa, Africa, Sweden, and bringing your experience into that answer, right? And you can also look at which maybe the sectors, as we said, I think in the previous one panel, you can be biased towards the sector, whether like I think this healthcare, agriculture, education, or whichever ones might be interesting to you. Yeah, we can start.
So I'll kick off. I mean, so my background's really in sort of knowledge work. So Thomson Reuters is a company that focuses on data services, actionable information for bankers, lawyers, and accountants, right? So I think what AI has done in those spaces, which is where my expertise kind of lies, is made them smarter at their jobs using tools that can reflect back. That expertise has been, I think, transformational for many professionals. I think I'll leave it there.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to start in the end of AI being actually a powerful opportunity for us to democratize things across sectors. Actually, if we start with healthcare, I think the first aspect you think about is, well, for the staff, right? For doctors and nurses and so on, their life and opportunity to actually create value for the patients can be improved by AI. We can have a lot of value for patients, and we can actually, for society, lower the cost of healthcare. So these are really strong opportunities, right? But if we don't manage to create this value across countries, across continents, right, we will have democratic issues. So the opportunity is there, but we need to take it somehow, both by generating value in that individual hospital, but also finding collaborative ways where we can actually share those learnings and those solutions. If we manage to do that, this is extremely powerful. And perhaps the most extreme example of this is education. I mean, we have tools now that actually can democratize and personalize education to extreme extent, but it's not going to come by itself, right? So we need to figure out a way to do that. And even in Sweden, you could imagine that schooling and the education sector is well organized. It might be to some degree, but it's also very fragmented, very decentralized. To an degree that the individual teacher needs to come up with what tools to use for improving education. So if we will tackle that and do it in the right way, I think it has phenomenal powers to actually take us and leapfrog us into a great future. But we need to do this collectively. We need to collaborate on these things to make it happen. And there are obstacles that we can come back to that are generic for any sector. But there is a true opportunity to not only disrupt sectors to the worst, for the weakest, but also to actually distribute the power of AI to all. And I'm really happy about the panel that has discussed what you also said, the value, how we can get communities to benefit and so on. I think these are really interesting aspects in that ambition.
So I want to cover two aspects. The first one is the democratization of AI. I think that's going to be and is rapidly accelerating over the past year. If you look at some statistics, Uber took 70 months to reach 100 million users. Instagram took 30 months, and OpenAI took 2 months. And I think if you just look at that trend, the acceleration and pace of innovation at the moment is so rapid that what we talk about today can easily change tomorrow. So that's the one component that I wanted to mention. The second part is we often, when we talk to our clients and we present at conferences, we talk about this concept of how difficult it is to get an AI solution operationalized and running, actually being used. It costs on average $80,000 and a team of 5 to 6 engineers to build, test, deploy and manage an AI solution. And most companies in South Africa can't afford to do that. The ones that can protect their IP quite religiously, and those are mostly in the enterprise sector. What we want to do is to bring these types of solutions to the smaller businesses, make it easier for them to use these solutions tailored to their business without them having to build the teams, build the infrastructure, and deploy those solutions on their own. So that's one aspect that we're looking at. And I think that's what we're doing, but I see that being quite a massive innovation and transformation across most of the industries in South Africa. From a healthcare, and I think education as well, it's going to be around hyper-personalization. So how do you create a very personalized engagement with the patient, with the student that is in their language of choice? Is it a chatbot? probably not. I don't think it will be, but it will use the chatbot technology to create a more engaging interface. And we're building solutions that take voice and video into consideration when engaging with learners in an education type system, providing them with study support and assistance, helping them to explain complex concepts that might not even be in their language of their choice in a very simple way for them to understand, and to do it in a way that's not just a text, you know, chat, but it could be a call, it could be a video chat with an AI avatar that maybe resembles their lecturer or someone that they really trust and can learn from. So the personalization is around taking their learning styles and applying it in a way that they can get the most out of it. And I think that's mostly in education and healthcare, but I think a lot of the corporates are trying to do that with their financial services, which hopefully is for the benefit of the consumer and not the bank or the big retailer.
Okay, I think thanks, Mabigat, for the comments there. I think the things that have come out is like on side of the place of role players in these spaces, that it's not, again, just the one single view. There's lots of role players that we need to think about and who come in. The other from Martin is the interconnectedness of people. We also might assume, and I guess it comes with any field, right? If you're outside the field and you see another field, like, that field is much better, they're better organized, they know these things. But then once you interact, you start noticing the same kind of challenges as your field has. So how does that work? And then there's the capability plus capacity, I think that Greg is alluding to. And maybe Greg, we'll start with you on the other way, maybe building on this, is that in saying that in like a lot of industry is battling with that capacity and capability, where do you believe in your side? And this is like, you know, my, oh, it's a selfish question that I put in here. Where do you believe R&D fits in these spaces within a country? Right? How does it maybe make Melio AI's life easier going into the future? Or does it make it harder, given your experience within the South African
sphere? Yeah, I think it's such a good question. And my first answer is, why aren't we working with R&D and academia more often? And when I started to think about this and take a step back, there are multiple role players in an ecosystem, and it's about an ecosystem. And academia and R&D players had a very important role in that. So if you think about business, they're probably the closest to the real life challenges and problems that are being experienced. Research and academia provide fresh skills, fresh thinking and capability to have, you know, intense focus on solving a problem. So if business come to academia with problems, then the academia can direct resources to solve it, which you can't do in business. That you always spread, you know, doing 10 things at the same time, and you often don't get the outcomes that you want. I think government has a role to play, not just about helping us to protect the ethical and responsible use of AI, but also to make sure that it's a seamless process, that engagement between academia and business. And then I come from a small business. I've worked in large corporates as well. It's often quite a closed door, enterprise and small business. It would be great to see a much better collaboration between the two. So the problems identified at business, that ground roots, academia help to create solutions. Small business can help to productionalize and test those in the field. And large businesses can help fund the scaling of those solutions for mass adoption. And that should be a continuous cycle where everyone contributes and everyone gains something out of it as well.
You have to stop me here, Bukusu, because this is an important topic. I can talk for hours on this. And Niklas, who's here in the front row, is involved in the biggest AI research program, research program period in history in Sweden. So privately funded. So we have discussed this at length, actually. I think there are a country that gets it right to really get collaboration going between academia and businesses will stand a very good chance. Because I don't think this has been figured out. The best example we have is Canada. We have been there on the ground, represented for 3 years, because we saw their AI research being really at the top. And there are a few learnings really that one needs to understand, I think, if one should tackle this question. AI research is slightly different from most other research. We'll come back to the language model, because it's kind of an exception to AI research in my perspective. In most cases, AI research is done on standardized data. And the real interesting data is in industry, or in public sector for that matter. But we don't do that connection. So we actually perform research on data that is slightly less relevant. And the effect of this is what Canada calls, it's about competence transfer, not technology transfer. They have realized that it's not technology they're building, it's competence, people. And if you don't want to structure collaboration between academia and industry, you have to move the people. And this is not so easy, right? Because we're all humans, and we are part of the dynamic where we work. In this case, most of you here at UP. And you have your dynamics there, you have your incentives there, and so on. So if we don't manage to create those incentives of you guys in academia to actually work with guys like Greg and in the private sector, this is not going to happen. And this is universal. It comes back to my country as well, where we have, as I said, in the most well-funded research program ever. So actually, the researchers are less incentivized to actually go out and look for collaboration. So back to that, if we can figure this out, we have a very good chance, because the competence you build has an important, a very important role to play in actually this stuff getting implemented. And I'd like just to end and come back to the language models, because the language technology is applied to data that is kind of generically available. You scrape the net if you want to be, if you want to describe it easily. So that that's openly accessible data that you work on. So that's an that's a little bit of an exception actually to AI research in general. Why is it important? Yeah, it's important because it's an example of fundamental solutions and models and artifacts that Paul mentioned that are really critical for the industry to actually build on. And I really think the first panel was so important because it really highlighted the challenges you have as South Africa or Africa in general with a number of languages and so on, right? Because this is fundamental technology that anyone in the industry needs to build on. We need to figure that out too. And there are more examples of that strategic kind of things that academia is well placed to build if it focuses. Right? Well, we can continue. You have to stop me, as I said.
So I come out of corporate innovation and out of that space specifically. And what I realize now, kind of transitioning into the work that I'm doing, is that it's quite similar to R&D in a university setting. And I find myself in these kinds of conversations and talking to folks in university because it's kind of a space that I'm comfortable in, kind of having done that in corporate. So I think there's a real opportunity to be, because corporates are, you know, tens of thousands of person strong organizations, and sort of what does it mean to partner with a corporate? You need to make sure you're partnering with the right people, teams inside of corporate. And I think that the innovation teams, the corporate social responsibility teams, these people who are sort of responsible for thinking about where the company is going, how it's going to position itself for the future, those are the groups of individuals inside of corporates that need to be engaged at the university level and having conversations. So I think the right kind of matchmaking is important. And I think it's also super critical for corporate innovation teams to sort of have almost the soft landing, if you will, of the university research and development kind of space, because it gives these corporate innovations these sort of not business as usual type of creations room to breathe in spaces where they're meant to breathe. It's meant to sort of, innovation's meant to happen at a university level. It's meant to happen in corporates as well, but frankly, the earnings cycle is like death and help for innovation to be transformational. I think what we find in corporates often is that innovation is very incremental. And it doesn't, it's not going to get us where we need to go from a really sort of future-proofing, inclusive, regenerative environment that we want to create.
Thanks. Thanks all. But I think maybe building on from that side, can you then comment then on the role of industry, both local and global, then building better AI for all of us? Because I think that's where your passions are. Like, what does it mean?
What does it mean? And I love the question that you posed earlier about, like, dare to dream, right? I think what it means, if we're able to get it right, or when we get it right, is that everyone is able to participate in a fully personalized, optimized for my own use case, my own context, my own way of viewing the world, experience across a number of different categories, right? Could be education, could be healthcare, could be my own personal profession. I mean, you think we even see it with the GPTs, right? Like, the more you engage, the more it's talking to you. Like, that is, amazing. And I think continuing along that path, continuing on that path in a way that is inclusive, I think could be really exciting.
I think for Martin, Can you talk a bit about how AI Sweden's come from your perspective? You've worked to build local capacity, right? This might go back to Greg's note about local companies. How have you been instrumental in that piece?
Yeah, perfect. That also ties very nicely to what I said. I think one needs to realize that we can't work in silos on this, right? Industry must make money. We know that, otherwise it won't work. And we want them to make money, want them to make business out of AI, because that is salaries, that is tax for us to run whatever other things we need to run as a society, right? And the industry doesn't want to have a society where we have huge gaps between different groups, because that is not a society to run businesses in, right? So I think it's really AI is the extreme of a need to get together and in broad partnership actually tackle these things. And that is in essence what we have done at Sweden. We even have a mindset that we call invest together, share with many. So we really manifested this idea in how we operate. And it works. We tell our partners very clearly, you don't do business with us, we are not for profit. If you do business with each other, we're happy because it means that something is happening, but not with us. Here you collaborate and build knowledge. And we want you to build that knowledge in a way that we can share it with whomever we like. So we have no NDAs. We really base everything on engagement on a voluntary basis. And try to really drive that engagement in best possible way. And I think for me, as the leader and the architect behind it, the best comment I can have from partners saying, wow, what energy you have in your team. Because that's everything we live on, right? to be that center of engagement where organization, companies, individuals, teams come together, look at common problems, and take a stab at solving them, or come somewhat of a way of solving them, and in a way where we can share. And we really try to balance the sharing so that partners contributing cash or otherwise to the capacity building, to your point, to your question, gets, let's say, the knowledge first. But we really want it to be out there. Although we engage more with partners to help them faster adopt these solutions or knowledge or best practices or whatever it is. So I think it's really, Sweden has been an exercise of setting a mindset, building a culture in the team that created the opportunity to gradually build capacity. It's maybe difficult to understand exactly what I'm saying, but the engagement allowed us to build capacity gradually. And working in an environment where engagement is everything, it's extremely rewarding. But if you can manage to get that going, you will attract good people and you will attract new partners and you can gradually build. And then obviously, just as any non-for-profit space, including universities, you need to have some kind of funding agencies around you that funds some of the strategic projects you want to do. And we've been fortunate in that aspect so far. But the foundation of AI Sweden is this engagement of building on partners' collaborative spirit.
And I think, Greg, for you is for people in the room and online who might be thinking about how the technology gets into organizations and scale, what are the top tips there? What's been... How does Melio helps other organizations do this? So what are the main things that keep on coming back up in terms of doing it right?
Yeah, I think we spoke about having a team of 6 to 7 people. Those are skill sets that are important in developing these solutions, not just from a technical point of view, but understanding the business value or the tangible value that you're trying to achieve. So from an outside, the skill that we look for the most is curiosity in our team. And I think that is another way of saying dare to dream. Those people that are looking for new ways. This is breaking up a bit. Yeah. Can you all hear me all right still? Okay. So the curiosity, which helps you to think about things differently and apply your mind differently. But when it comes to adopting solutions in organizations, the biggest challenge is always the data. And we heard about it with languages in the last panel discussion. It applies to everything in AI, really. It's all about the data, quality of data. So we often spend about 80% of our time structuring and forming the data in a way that's going to give you an output that you can use. Once you've got that, then you need to understand how you can actually get that model to the front lines. Where you're going to put, is it going to sit on an app? How's it going to work? How are you going to get feedback into this process to continuously improve it? That is not an easy thing to do. So we work closely with organizations to guide them through that journey, to help them to actually improve, deploy and improve the models that they have.
Thanks. I think maybe one question that can go around. So actually next week we were supposed to have the Global AI Summit on Africa, but that's been postponed to next year probably in April. It's supposed to be in Kigali in Rwanda. And that's going to be probably a gathering of maybe 1,000 or so, especially people who are decision makers across the continent. And if again you think about that context of where industry sits in, what are maybe the things you say to industry about being in these spaces? And then what are the things that you're saying to decision makers in what should be done? I think that's it's again bringing it back of like where I think for a lot of us, the reason we're having this conversation, and I think Sweden and the Swedish embassy will be going down to also the Cape from tomorrow. The reason these conversations keep on happening over and over again, not just here on the African continent, but in South America and Southeast Asia, is that with every industrial revolution, there is the concept of winners and losers. And then if you lose, you're just kind of a bit behind, right? But then if you lose because of multiple industrial revolutions, because of different things, whether there was war, whether there was colonialism, whether that's all these reasons, now you're at this part where we're sitting and there's more of these kind of cyber physical systems, and now we're seeing this acceleration. There's just that feeling that if we're also fall behind here, is there even an opportunity to call back in the future? So if now we're having these big meetings that now supersede even the smaller one, which is I think is probably going to be, this one would be more interesting than the bigger one. What are the things that I think you would want to get into those rooms, or even the people you would suggest be in those rooms so that both sides understand? You can start off, Martin, if you want to.
Let's see if this works, the battery's running out. But obviously a big question. If we start with industry, I think what we talk a lot about is leadership. Really trying to get business leaders to understand that they need to learn themselves. They need to understand AI to a degree that they can actually see if their own company's potential value and what it takes to get there. Leadership is about showing direction. It's about investing. And this doesn't happen if they don't know the field themselves. And I think if we look at the companies that are ahead in this field, they have very, very strong leadership, actually. So that is the first point. That actually is for, let's say, the national decision makers, politicians. They also need to understand it to the degree where they can actually make good decisions for their country. This is maybe sometimes more of a wish than anything else, but we need to help them. I think if we come back to the discussion earlier today, I think the way to look at what we discussed in a previous panel is to see it as infrastructure. Any country would very naturally invest in their roads, in their water system, in the electricity system, right? This is just such investment that needs to happen sooner or later. Call it digital infrastructure or AI infrastructure, doesn't really matter, but you need to build these things, including competence that your industry and your public sector is going to be based on, or help that these organizations can build on. Because if you don't have it, then you're going to lag behind. The last comment, I think, is that, which had an excellent question over here earlier about ownership and investing in data. This race has just begun. So if we take ownership, if we decide this is going to be ours, right, we can, even if we don't have the data today, we can start to create it. Your answer was very good. We can start to create it, but we need leadership to actually do that right. So it all comes back there somehow. Well, I'll stop there.
So I love the question, and I want to build on Martin's answer as well. So there are two sort of thoughts that come to me as I think about like having all these leaders in a room. And first, everything I do is about daring to dream. So I think there are two. One, specifically thinking about the African context and the role, power, side of the informal economy. I think that figuring out how to better understand that, how to better tap into that, how to better, from a government perspective, monetize that, I think is super interesting and a big challenge, and something that it would make sense to me to have leadership thinking about within these spaces. So that's one. I think also coming back to leadership is another I, intentionality, which I think is super important and sometimes gets kind of left out or not made explicit. And so what we are saying we're trying to build is an inclusive, regenerative future. Then data sets that we're creating, the ways that we're thinking about engaging with communities should be reflective of that. And I think it was the lady earlier who was talking about in law, right? I was asking the question about common law versus civil law. And her answer was that, well, it's actually neither one of those. It's more like the I versus the we, which is a fundamental difference between the way we work and think about things in the West, and perhaps something that we can learn from and build into AI solutions of the future if we leverage some of the knowledge systems and ways of being more like OT, because then that kind of gets us out of the zero sum, out of the winners and losers, and these spaces where actually we can have and move towards an environment or a mindset that is more grounded in abundance and not scarcity, which is what a lot of our economics is based on now.
Yeah, I think happy I was going last because I want to build off what the two of you said. So leadership and we, I think if you combine that, it's about shared leadership and shared goals. And it's not about defining goals that, you know, are too broad. It's about being quite specific and focused. So selecting maybe the two or three top goals that are going to derive the highest amount of benefit for the industry. And then use that, create baselines and measure your progress against that. Measure it regularly. Apply what you would do in a project to what we can do at a more broader scale.
Okay, I think with that, let's open up for some questions from the room. I obviously will always have, like, I have more questions, but then I thought it would be always, let's get the conversation going. Thanks for the panelists so far answering the questions. Anybody who have some questions? We'll take a few again, like two or three. Get some answers.
Thank you so much, sir. I have two questions. Maybe they may not have direct or explicit answers to it, but one concerns the gentleman in the middle there mentioned about using data that is, said, less suitable or less standard That I can't remember exactly the term we used, but my question on that one is, do we use that data to train the models, test them, and deploy them to work on the same type of data, or you can apply them to standardized data, if I would say? And then the other question is, you were speaking about leadership. In your opinion, I know AI doesn't go with just computing on the other side, like you mentioned, some infrastructure and development. Like, I understand there's a lot of consumption of electricity, of water, and stuff. Do you think African governments are keeping in pace with such development? Thank you.
My question is two. Number one, I don't know what's your perspective in terms of when, because I think it's also related to R&D, that would it be possible for corporate organization that they come up with policy, or maybe there's going to be a general policy whereby they're able to disclose amount of energy that they're using in terms of running all these generative large language models, and whatever policy they get from here, they can actually also throw it to academia to be also to be able to build that skill that you're talking about. That's the one question that I'm wanting to get your view about. Another question I also wanted to get your view about is about what is actually the consequence of this AI model or generative AI model in terms of the whole strategy of turning around an organization of profit? So that's just my two questions.
Hi, I just have a question on R&D. What is the actual challenge that we have? I understand the motivation why we should actually go ahead and incorporate it in enterprise, but what is the actual challenge that, the key challenge that we have currently to actually do that? And the second question is for Martin. You said Sweden has had some sort of success incorporating R&D. And for us that we're not as advanced, what are the sort of trends that you've seen that made it successful in order to incorporate R&D in the enterprise?
So I'll just jump in up some thoughts that came to me about power and optimization and going back to the dare to dream. And could we imagine there? So I'm American, if you probably haven't noticed from my voice, but I've been living in Cape Town for the last 10 years, right? So I'm sort of, as my daughter refers to herself, the South African American. So when I think about how power is used in the US, there's quite a bit of waste. So imagine a space, right, a global power market that was able to sort of optimize for time zones, for all of the sun, for, you know, when power is needed, when it's hot, when we could shut off the air conditioning and our high rises and work at night because no one's there, but actually that power now is rerouted somewhere else. So I think that, like, there are many ways to dream and imagine for these, for us to better use existing resources. It does come down to willing, conscious, intentional leadership to start, and then other things as well. I'll pass.
All right, let's try to answer these questions. First, energy. It happens that we will on Thursday present some inspiring tools for deploying solar with battery solutions. And one reason for doing this and investing in that is that we know that AI will consume some energy. Sweden is now, I've heard, the fifth, country number five in when it comes to AI-specific infrastructure deployments. Is that good or bad? Well, we have a large degree of hydro in Sweden, so maybe we can take some of that responsibility. But that is really a national question. How should we balance our efforts? Should we invest in computational power and have that on the ground of the country for security, for sovereignty or so? Or should other countries actually spend our energy driving those and rent whatever we need, right? It's a tricky question. But yes, we need to address the energy question. The second question then about the success. I think there are many answers to that. Tradition is one, but I think the success that I want to mention is basically there is a big portion of the Swedish private sector realizing that they need to operate in an ecosystem where there is solutions, competence, and so on. And I'm absolutely sure that you have the same in South Africa. If you can identify the key decision makers willing to actually be part of driving that ecosystem of competence, solutions, collaboration, and so on, and I'm absolutely convinced that those individuals exist, you should build together with them. What is maybe easier in Sweden, but I can tell you it's not easy, is to have that private-public partnership where industry ships in to get with the government. It's not the tradition is there in Sweden, but in AI, the government hasn't really started to play yet. So it's difficult from that perspective. But here, I'm pretty sure that the private side would actually drive that collaboration and that ecosystem because they need it. But you need to be able to tap into that somehow. And I don't have a solution for South Africa, but that's what I think we should mention as our success.
So the question around the data, I think there's a saying that every model is wrong, but some are useful. So I think depends on the use case, the benefit that you're trying to achieve. You need to understand what is acceptable. And once you've got that and you've got some value out of it, then what are the next steps that you can take? What other data can you bring in that can make it better? And then go through almost a continuous improvement process to do that. You'll experience a lot of challenges along the way, I'm sure. From an energy consumption point of view, I think it's critical that our reporting standards to include energy reporting for, you know, physical facilities as well as AI and software solutions. Obviously, AI is in the limelight at the moment and probably will be for a while. I think it's for every 100 words that ChatGPT generates, it costs 3 bottles of water. That's terrible. So we need to bring in more innovative energy solutions to support this, because AI is going to be here. That's going to create more opportunities than, you know, lose. And that's going to impact Africa quite a bit, I think. There are a lot of questions. I think the R&D one might be more for Bukosi, but I think, I think from an R&D point of view, the challenges are, I'm sure, abundant. From a small business point of view, like I said at the beginning, why aren't we working with more R&D institutions? It's a no-brainer, really. I think there's a massive synergy there. For me, let's open more of those doors. Let's create, it's one of our values is win-win. So let's see how we can work together to benefit both the R&D perspective, but also the business. We're a small business, so, you know, we're usually in survival mode, and I think most small businesses in South Africa are like that. So how can we create a synergy where R&D and academia can help drive solutions in industry that matter and work for small businesses that can then apply that and to make that available to consumers and the end users at the end of the day?
Yeah, thanks, Greg, Martin, and Saida for that. So yeah, R&D is important because we have to think about how we make the future, right? And some parts of our society have to be thinking about that for all of us. So some ways of looking at this is GDP. I mean, R&D spent in terms of GDP per capita. South Africa at the moment is at about 0.6%, I think, from the last science and innovation kind of reporting, I think, from back. Stand to be corrected. The US, just as an example, is somewhere at 3.8. But we're at 0.6. We used to be at 0.8 before COVID, and then COVID happened. And a lot, that 25% drop was, I think, attributed to mostly private sector pulling out, moving money out of R&D. And from a lot of studies, the increase in research spending correlates with better outcomes for populations, I mean, the citizens of that country in general. So we're just saying that we kind of, even though, like, you know, the economy is one thing, but then we've also kind of now had a cut on how far our well-being is going to be because we've reduced the amount of money available for R&D by 25%. Also, I stand to be corrected, a region, not even a country, like Shenzhen in China, I think they do like 5%. Right? But then in other places, historically, that R&D spend is driven by government, because they can take a long-term view and say, like, we can do this for the next 30 years, and we know why we're funding R&D in general. At the moment, South Africa, as an example, we're in austerity mode. That increase happening from government is going to be hard. The university has had its budgets cut because DHET has cut, subsidies and how much they give governments. DSI has had its budget cut, and as such, money that you get from people like the NRF has gone down. So these are not things, if you're thinking about the short term and you're thinking about AI as being maybe one of the, okay, not maybe, one of the big R&D opportunities that we have. In that short term, money is going to have to come from somewhere, even spaces that traditionally take like benefit from R&D later and then start putting money. So the whole thing that we have big tech in the US right now driving a lot of money in R&D is actually not the beginning, it's the end of the process. The process, you go back 70 years ago and you look at the US government's investments in R&D and investments in research into AI. And now you see kind of the, the outcomes, and you're like, oh yeah, that's why you should fund it. It's not the big tech examples. It's the examples going back. If you look at, if you don't know, you can go research the story of Siri. Siri on the iPhone being a system that you can talk to goes back, I think, to DARPA research. That was a research project started by the U.S. government that said that we want to create this universal assistant, virtual assistant. And we're going to give money to some of the top researchers in the US for years. They were just giving money and people were meeting every year showing how far their research is. And then gets to a point where there's a company that gets started as a spin-off out of that research, which is called Siri Technologies. That company gets bought by Apple. Then you get Siri on your phone. Right, it is not the, we tend to think maybe sometimes of the end and think like, oh, the end is the pattern. That's not the pattern. The pattern actually goes way before. And that's the thing we're sitting on, that every time, history you can look at for some examples, but then it has to be contextual. We can't at the moment, it's very hard, you know, thinking about our health, poverty in South Africa, to say we're just going to multiply our R&D spend overnight, maybe by eight. I don't think any politician in South Africa would go you know, campaigning and saying, yeah, so we're going to cut all this other stuff. Not that, you know, government is completely efficient, but then it's a thing that we need to then think also innovatively about where R&D investments are going to come from in the country. So that's just an example.
We'll see. Maybe we'll share the city story. I think she does a guy who gives a talk about that. I think when he was giving the AAAI lecture, he gives like a very nice lecture about charting the technology path for that. There are some questions online, and then we'll take a few from here. Online from Zama Sibia. In a cooperative exercise, how would the panelists suggest combining disruptive design with modern and developing innovation to address societal issues? That's number one. How can we support the university leading curriculum-based research and development efforts? Maybe we'll keep it at that. We'll keep it at that. The other ones get a little bit more complex. Let's get one or two more questions, and then we'll try to. You know, it's like end of the day on a Monday.
I think following the trend set so far, I'm going to ask my question two parts. So the first part, okay, obviously it's going to relate a lot more to education since that's the area where I'm more involved with. But in terms of democratization and personalization of education, what do you think are the impacts going to be on accreditation of curriculum and standardized testing that's being applied? So obviously this can have potential impacts on non-AI, quote unquote, industries that rely on specific course sequences to be completed. And the second part is everybody knows about the disruptive impact of the generative AI on education systems. Now, there's apparent conflict because obviously, like you correctly pointed out, Martin, that the companies need to make money, and preferably they need to make a profit in the end. And they can't make a profit by taking away features from the AI. So how can educational institutions and private sector industries work together to find a compromise in this aspect? Or are we looking at the end of traditional assessments and we just have to find new assessments?
I think maybe to add to also it might be maybe instructive, Martin, to talk a bit maybe more about opportunities for more cooperation maybe between South Africa and Sweden, and what opportunities that there might be in this space.
Shall we end with that?
Let's see
if we can answer these questions first. Who want to go on those two? Maybe you should repeat those questions.
Oh yeah, sure. I think it was how do you combine disruptive design and innovation to address social issues? Right, maybe from your perspective, I know you're coming a lot from thinking about industry. Maybe let us say, like, we'll keep it at that. I think maybe the question also about curricular changes is connected. Yeah.
I'm not sure that I fully understand that question.
But yeah.
Design.
I think simplified is how can we go about innovation and still get benefits for the ones less privileged?
Maybe we can.
I just would say we must include them in the process, the innovation process, and then there's an example.
So we've got a project working with a startup in healthcare. And they want to bring sexual and reproductive health advice to those that can't afford it or they can't access that kind of healthcare. And they're looking at working with us to implement like a toll-free hotline that's driven by AI and voice AI in a language of their choosing. Ideally, that will be the end goal. So it is evolutionary. We will probably start with English, we have. But the goal is not English. That's really just to prove the model works and then to expand it to, depending on the areas that we're helping, the language of their choice. So they would effectively dial like a toll-free line or send a lightweight message, you know, like a USSD message to say that they've got a question and need help. The solution would then call them back and have an actual engagement with them, understanding the problem in more detail, understanding what kind of support they need, and then to recommend what kind of steps they can take or provide them with that educational knowledge that they need. And ideally, the end goal will be to do that in not just the language of their choice, but also the delivery of that language. And that requires working with, you know, a lot of partners to bring that to life. I think that's a good example of disruptive technology coming through and impacting society positively.
Yeah, and then to your question about validating knowledge. I'm for sure not an expert here, but my perspective is that, yes, we definitely need to change the way we validate knowledge. I really think that we need to figure out a way where students have access to the best possible tools, because that's how they're going to operate when they graduate. How to do that is perhaps difficult, but I think at least we sense a willingness from the big companies to play in that. Any other strategy, and Sweden is actually on the other side, where we want to go back to paper and pencil, I think is just wrong. It's not right for the students. So I really think we need to build education on using these tools, but it's a big debate. Right? We have even students being penalized for using generative AI tools in their exams as well. And we need to have clear rules, right? But back to validation, I think I spoke for the entire educational system of Denmark, and there was one other keynote from a guy at MIT, and his perspective was that we need to stop validating knowledge. We need to go towards validating thinking. That's the best answer I can get, because I think it's from a mindset perspective, it's interesting. They also had very, very strong push at MIT in changing the curriculum, they call it. They wanted a student to be bilingual in a sense, right? That they could both know their domain, biology or whatever, and data science, so that they actually had both when they graduated. I think that this is really interesting. They even had program structure where they could have basically a dual degree somehow. I don't know the system really. But I think this is also mirrored in some of the discussions we have with industry. AstraZeneca, one of the largest pharma companies, said is, we find the biologists and chemists that we need, but they don't have the modern tools. So they had to actually give the new recruits the data science tools, the ML tools and so on. And that's a completely data science, data-driven business in a sense. But I think that is quite important.
Okay. I think with that, maybe Martin, any thoughts on opportunities then for collaboration, given also, I think, the week that you guys are spending.
No, definitely. I really want to echo what our ambassador said before. We need to do this together. With that mindset, I mean, it's more about finding the specific projects and specific collaboration and ways of funding those. I like to be very clear on one thing, and that was clear to me during the first panel. I think it was very humbling to listen to that one. And I think representing then Europe, if you wish, right? I think we need to enter those discussions in a very humble way, because we need to fully understand the prerequisites that you have and the challenges that are here that are different from what we have, right? As a small country in language perspective, right, we have maybe better understanding than others, but we still need to deeply understand the aspects that were discussed this morning or after lunch, right? That is critical. I think we need to approach these collaborations really on a mutual benefit perspective, with the idea that also we that sometimes tend to think that we know more should learn. And I think this is really the case. We need to tie into whatever funding mechanisms there are. You mentioned Bill Gates, for instance. I mean, that's brilliant to use that foundation. We, from the Swedish delegation, we believe that the European Union has a strong drive to put in place some funding mechanisms for these collaborations. I think we collectively, as representatives for Sweden, we really want to be one of your key partners in Europe. You should not turn to us as the single partner, for sure. You should work with other nations and so on. But we'd like really to be one of your key collaborators in Europe. And let us together figure out where we can contribute. Listening this morning, I was thinking that, okay, computational power, compute, that's an easy one, right? That is more finding whomever is interested in paying for that. But you were so clearly saying that it's not about that, right? It's about the competence. So whatever collaboration we set up, I think we really need to have a mindset of building competence. If we can do that and share in both directions, we should at least from a let's say mindset approach be in the best position. So that was very generic. I mean, we would very much like to discuss any topic to see how we can do this. AI is a great topic for collaboration because it goes across, the challenges are the same across sectors, but they're also the same more or less across nations. So let's really be open in both directions to see what we can start with. We at AI Sweden, we really believe in going from talking to taking action. This is our signal. We really want to do that. I myself get very restless if we talk too long before getting something in the ground. Yeah. So we would very much like to first find those first exchanges. Could be on a simple basis, two people going in one or the other direction to start to share. It could be actually setting up a joint team on language models to see what could we extract from the European Union in terms of funding for specific components of what we need to do that. So really, I want you to take with you a great interest from our side to find those first things, and then we can build on it.
I think I'll go with Greg in terms of your final words, and then Saida, you be the person who really has the the final word in that space. I don't know. Yeah,
I think those are great sentiments, and I think the opportunities that you think are here, they're probably 10 times more than what you think even. So I do think that it's worth exploring, working with. And I think that maybe this is the perfect opportunity to partner academia with small business startups that have the passion, the drive, and the need to survive and thrive by delivering solutions that make a difference, that can scale, that can benefit more people. And I think start small. Let's find something that works well. Let's use that as a blueprint to then scale it out. And I think we can grow the relationship significantly from that.
Yeah, so for the final word, I think I would just say thank you for convening this space for us to kind of dream together, think together, create a space to potentially partner together going forward. I think one other note that I would also just kind of put out there is that while we talked a lot about sort of innovating data and creating new data sets and alternative data, I think we're also and should be also thinking about innovating data science itself and how we think about what it is. And to your point about the compute power that we know we need and the water that it takes and the impact on the environment, it's not actually quite sustainable, these large language models that we love so much. So I think we also need to be taking a step back and saying, how might we get a similar or even better result and not actually have such a negative impact on the environment? What about inference models, right? Models that are not sort of generative, that take all the processing because you got to make it so many times, right? So I think that, and I will leave it there and hand it over to our host. Thank you.
All right, thanks everyone. And I think maybe also leading on from what Greg said, one of the things last week I was visiting vets on Thursday, and the DVC there actually was just reflecting on the place where, where universities are sitting in terms of the innovation space. And on my side, yes, I'm at Lilapa AI as a co-founder, and I have five other co-founders with me, and all of them have come from UP or Vets University, right? And there's still some of us are staying in academia as well, driving this part. And we were reflecting then on Melinda, who's the CEO at Melio AI. She also comes from Vets University. She was in electrical engineering. I was in electrical engineering there. Well, she was much younger than me, so she came at a different time, but I do remember, I think, visiting one time at the university and she was there. But then the part again that we tend to maybe ignore and think about industry as just being on one side, but then the skills that are built are the ones that end up being in these spaces, and how do we just bridge those gaps? And those other pieces then require an inquisitive mind, that part of then identifying where there's opportunity for us to build things together, and then also know that, yeah, some things on one side, you have a company, the company has to survive, and there are things that have to be done. There will be opportunity to also see how do you then give back to community. But what does that mean? As TGOK highlighted earlier, is also different. It's not necessarily money. We shouldn't just think that it's money. And then how then do we imagine our futures together, right? And that's going to be the thing that becomes, I think, important. And I hope people are taking away from these interactions today that we want to impart the knowledge that people can know more and not be scared. On one side, two, that the future is together. We just have to find where we fit and then what we can do in those spaces. And I think with that, I'm very thankful to all the people who administratively were helping, both on the Sweden side and the University of Pretoria side. We're very thankful for the library for hosting us. It was hard actually to get this venue. It's always hard to, so it was something where I think it should be here. It can't be somewhere else. And we were able to make this, thanks for the Data Science for Social Impact Group, Data Science Law Lab, AI Sweden, the Swedish Embassy, and all the leadership that was here, all the panelists. I know some people are going to fly back to Cape Town for the Swedish delegation. Enjoy your time in South Africa. We do hope, enjoy the Cape as well. And then, I look forward to seeing what we do after all of this has marinated, and then we think how we can connect. And I think for the university, for the people who are coming from the University of Pretoria, the whole point of us having these seminars and webinars is just to keep those conversations going. But then, as Martin said, we are interested in the actions that you take. If at the end of the day, this makes you change or add a new collaboration that you wouldn't have done before, please, for me, it's lovely getting an email once in a while saying, after that we started doing this and now it's created this innovation. It is about what we do after this. The reason I think we put the panelists that we did go with to come here is because they've walked the path. They've done the work in different spheres, and they were here to share and then also ideate with all of us in the room. So thank you. We'll finish a bit slightly earlier because I know the second panel was a little bit smaller, and I don't want to stress the panelists a bit too much when it comes to this. But for people to please get home safe, enjoy the last day of September, and at least we made it, right? We made it to that. Thanks, everyone.